Good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it's October 16th, and we are in the autonomic nervous system chapter. We're going to finish that up today and maybe move into sensory chapter. But let's look at a little bit more detail at the schedule. So schedule's on the right-hand side, and we said today is the 16th. Oh yeah, that little asterisk right there means that we've gone through the earthquake drill, because that started at 10:16. That's over. And we're going to do autonomic nervous system today. But that means also on Tuesday we have exam 2 on chapters 4, 5, 7, and 9. 9 is not a very long chapter. Most of it is a review. But we will have to talk about some neurotransmitters and receptors. That's probably something that's a little bit different than the anatomy that you're familiar with. And then after the test, we'll carry on with sensory physiology. Oh, good, we have another lecture on sensory physiology. All right, so does anybody have a question about anything, the schedule, the test? I do want to mention something about the test, if there aren't questions. So don't forget, what do you need for the test? Pencil, excellent eraser that works, that Scantron, what is that Scantron, 882? Maybe 882ES, but that's a LOVAS form, and a picture ID. Make sure you find that picture ID today so that you can grab it on Tuesday without having to waste a lot of time. Right? Make sure you have that picture ID. Otherwise, you're going to have to wait around for a grade, and I won't be very efficient in getting grades out to everybody. So if everybody just kind of helps, then everybody will get their grade fast. And I'll grade the exam right after you take it. So if you want to meet me outside my office, like we did last time, to review, that works for me. Okay? Okay, and that is on? Yeah, that is on Tuesday, right? The 21st. Yeah, question. I don't think you need a calculator. You might have to subtract numbers. Okay, and in which case maybe you would like a calculator, but I don't think you're not gonna have any logarithmic functions on this test. Yeah. Okay. Okay, do we have any announcements from SI? What's happening in SI?
Next Tuesday, right before the exam, we will have a review session, cancel session on Thursday. That's it. Happy studying.
Okay, thank you. All right, so we started autonomic nervous system last time, and let's carry on with that. All right, so autonomic nervous system. Let's just review real quick, just for my benefit. Autonomic as opposed to what other kind of nervous system? We have autonomic and, somatic nervous system. All right, what's the effector organ for the somatic nervous system? So that's, so it's not autonomic, right? And that is exactly right. It is skeletal muscle. It is under voluntary control, what that means, right? Voluntary control. Autonomic nervous system has other effector organs, not skeletal muscle. What are the effector organs for the autonomic nervous system? Cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and glands. That's right. So these things are under autonomic control. You can't control them. Maybe with the meditation techniques, you can influence some of these things one way or the other, but you can't control them like you can skeletal muscle. Like if you're hot and you start to perspire, you can't turn those sweat glands off, no matter how hard you practice, right? Because that's under autonomic control. It's all taken care of for you. You don't have to think about that. And if you do think about it, you can't control it anyway. In terms of the autonomic nervous system, what is the relation? How many divisions are there? There are two. And I suppose that shouldn't be a surprise because you have a biceps and a triceps muscle. So what do the two divisions of the autonomic nervous system, or what is the relationship between the two divisions of the autonomic nervous system? They're antagonistic to each other, and you agree that that is a good thing? Yeah, because that provides for balance and control. Yeah, precise control and balance. All right, so we're going to look at the two divisions. First, we're going to look at sympathetic. I think we talked about what sympathetic is. It's the fight or flight part of the autonomic nervous system, and we talked about some things that happen when the sympathetic nervous system is activated. And so let's carry on with these sympathetic divisions. So sympathetic outflow leaves the central nervous system, right? What is central nervous system? Let's make sure we're all tracking in the same way. What's central nervous system? Brain and spinal cord. Yeah, brain and spinal cord, central nervous system. So sympathetic outflow leaves through the thorax region and lumbar region. So we call it the thoracolumbar division from T1 to L2. That's the only way sympathetic nerve signals can leave the central nervous system. And how many neurons does it take for pretty much any autonomic outflow pathway to reach an effector organ? Okay. Somatic is?
One.
Autonomic is different. It is two. Yeah, it is two. So there is a second neuron, and there is usually a group of cell bodies of that second neuron someplace in the peripheral nervous system. So what do we call a bunch of nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system? A ganglion. What do we call it in the central nervous system? Nucleus, right? So that's how we come up with this term, ganglion. So in the autonomic nervous system, we have a preganglionic fiber leaving the central nervous system, right? And then we have the postganglionic fiber going to the target organ somewhere. And these ganglia are going to be located in different places depending on whether it's sympathetic or parasympathetic. On the slide before us, we see the sympathetic chain ganglia on either side of the vertebral column. So this is how sympathetic impulses leave the spinal cord, right? And before they get into a spinal nerve, they enter through the ganglia, which we call the sympathetic chain ganglia. And they're all linked together with nerves. And sometimes we call these the paravertebral ganglia because they're located on either side of the vertebral column. So this is one kind of ganglia that we have in the sympathetic division. You could think of these almost as like an auxiliary spinal cord just for sympathetic outflow. That's maybe one way to think of it. Okay. Next slide. Ah, good. Next slide. Let's talk about the characterization of the sympathetic nervous system. Last time we saw that it was the fight or flight, so just if you're thinking about the effects on a particular organ, just think about if you're in a stressful situation, what would be beneficial to you in particular, and or a particular organ. So the other way that we characterize the sympathetic division is that when it becomes activated, it's activated all over your body. We call that mass activation. And it does it by a couple of different ways. There's a structural modification of the sympathetic nervous system and also an endocrine modification. Let's look at the structural modification first. So when we say mass activation, the signals that leave the spinal cord diverge and go to numerous locations. So here we have a fiber, a nerve fiber, nerve cell bodies in the gray matter. As a matter of fact, that's the lateral horn, gray matter of the spinal cord, and it leaves the ventral root because you know the ventral root is motor, right? Dorsal root is sensory. Oh, let me get my cursor back. Otherwise, I'll drive everybody nuts. Ah, okay. So the preganglionic fiber leaves the ventral root, goes into the ramus, or the spinal nerve, and then it enters a pathway into the sympathetic chain ganglia. And the preganglionic fiber is myelinated, so does it have a gray appearance or a white appearance if it's myelinated? It has a white appearance, right? So this is the white ramus communicans, and so the preganglionic fiber enters, and a number of things can happen. It can synapse right in here on the postganglionic fiber, or it can split into numerous branches. And in this particular example, we see it split into numerous branches. Some of the branches ascend through the sympathetic chain, right? Others just pass right through, and some actually descend in the sympathetic chain. And then there's even some more branching that can happen in these other ganglia along the sympathetic chain. So this one signal in the preganglionic fiber splits up into many different axons, and it can go in many, many different places. So we call that divergence. That's one thing that promotes that mass activation. The other thing that I see on this slide, all right, is that If there is a axon that passes straight through the sympathetic chain, right, it has to have a ganglion someplace else. Because how many neurons does it take for autonomic outflow? Yeah, so here is one. And if the axon is passing straight through, it still has to synapse someplace to stimulate the postganglionic fiber. Here is another ganglion. It's not part of the sympathetic chain. These are usually located anterior to the vertebral column. So these we call the prevertebral because they're in front of, or sometimes we call these the collateral ganglia. And here then is the postganglionic fiber, and it goes to the target organ, target tissue. And so the dotted line represents the postganglionic neuron. And also you should know that this structurally it's different. It's not myelinated. It's just a gray fiber. Whenever you have a nerve that passes through the sympathetic chain and goes to a prevertebral ganglia, we're always going to call that what kind of nerve? Maybe you learned this in anatomy, kind of hope. That's always a splanchnic nerve, right? And there are a number of kinds of splanchnic nerves, but just remember, splanchnic nerve is for sympathetic outflow, and it goes directly to a collateral ganglia instead of the sympathetic chain ganglia. All right, so here we see divergence at this location, but another characteristic is convergence. And here is another example of convergence. We have axons from the same neuron joining back together in a collateral ganglia, and this just allows and makes sure that there are different routes that these important nerve impulses can get to its target tissue, for instance, if one of these nerves becomes damaged. So you could think of this almost as a plexus, where these signals get mixed. Okay, maybe I'll mention this real quick. Here is the preganglionic fiber coming in. Certainly it does come in the white ramus communicans. And if it synapses in this ganglia here, here's the postganglionic fiber, and then it re-enters the spinal nerve, and it follows the spinal nerve to wherever that target organ is. All right, so this would be the dorsal ramus, here would be the ventral ramus of a nerve, so the sympathetic fibers will just travel along with the other nerves in your body. The only thing that I recognize on this slide is that it's not quite anatomically correct. If you look at an anatomy book, you notice that the white ramus communicans is over here and the gray is over here. So I don't think that's important for this class, but maybe sometime you should realize that this figure is not quite accurate, right? That the myelinated fiber passes by the first communicans and goes into the second one to get into the sympathetic chain. Okay, so on this slide, basically we just see some more anatomy. We see the sympathetic chain ganglia. Here's the vertebral column. Here's the sympathetic chain on the left side. And then here are the collateral ganglia that are in front of the vertebral column, not on either side. So these are the prevertebral or the collateral ganglia. And here is a nerve that's passing through the sympathetic chain, going to a collateral ganglia, and that's what we would call a splanchnic nerve. There are a couple different kinds of splanchnic nerves, but I just want you to know the general rule for what a splanchnic nerve is. Okay, so I guess I'm going to go back to this slide right here. So the neurotransmitter that is released from the preganglionic fiber is acetylcholine. And there are nicotinic receptors in the postganglionic dendrites and cell body. And so what can you tell me? Well, you know a couple different kinds of receptors for acetylcholine. And the kind of receptor this is a nicotinic receptor. So what is the effect of the preganglionic fiber on the postganglionic fiber? It is always excitatory, just because, right, it's a cholinergic system and it uses a nicotinic type channel. So it is always excitatory. Now here is the postganglionic fiber and it goes to an effector organ. This is not a cholinergic fiber, this is an adrenergic fiber, or at least 95% of the time it's an adrenergic fiber. What the heck does that mean? Cholinergic means it secretes acetylcholine. Adrenergic means that it secretes norepinephrine. Okay, so the postganglionic fiber releases norepinephrine at the axon terminus. So there aren't nicotinic or muscarinic receptors for norepinephrine, right, there are what we call adrenergic receptors for norepinephrine. So that's a really important scheme that I want you to know about. So the preganglionic sympathetic is cholinergic. The postganglionic sympathetic is adrenergic most of the time. Okay. And we said that it usually takes, what, two neurons to get to the target tissue from the spinal cord. There's one really important exception to that rule. And I'm going to zoom ahead just a couple slides to get to this one right here. Here's a synopsis of the whole autonomic nervous system, but this is a good slide of what I want you to see. So here I see a bunch of spinal nerves leaving the spinal cord from T1 to L2, right? And it's going to be autonomic. So which of the two divisions are we looking at right here? It's got to be sympathetic, right? No parasympathetic outflow happens from this region. So these nerves then have to either synapse in the sympathetic chain, right? Or they have to pass through. So these right here synapse in the ganglia, and then here is the postganglionic fiber going, for instance, to the heart, for instance, or other places, right? And so we see the pre- and postganglionic fibers. Let's look in part, and you're going to see that to be the scheme pretty much for all of these organs, except for one that I see tucked away way down over here. So what is this kidney bean-shaped organ? That is a kidney, indeed. And there is something on top of it, and we call that the adrenal gland, which means on top of the kidney. And is there a dotted line going to the adrenal gland? There is no dotted line. And what does a dotted line represent? The postganglionic fiber. So in this outflow pathway, there is no postganglionic fiber. So this is what? An exception to that really important rule. So let's trace this back. So here is the preganglionic fiber just passing straight through the sympathetic chain ganglia. It goes into a prevertebral ganglia, and it passes straight through. It doesn't synapse. And it goes all the way to the adrenal medulla, right? And it's the cells of the adrenal medulla that are actually acting like a postganglionic cell, right? So I don't see a postganglionic cell, but the cells inside the adrenal gland act like one. And when there are action potentials or when neurotransmitter like acetylcholine is released by this preganglionic fiber, the response of the cells in the adrenal medulla is to secrete norepinephrine and epinephrine. And so it's very similar to what the job of a sympathetic postganglionic fiber is, except that these cells here don't transmit electrical impulses anywhere. They just, when they're stimulated, they just release norepinephrine and epinephrine. So let's go back. Okay. So the adrenal medulla, located in the adrenal gland, and you know what part of the adrenal gland is that, the superficial or the deep part? You should know that's deep, right? Because the medulla of anything is the deep part. What's the superficial part of anything? That would be the cortex, right? So goes to the medulla, not the cortex. And there are modified postganglionic cells there. When they become stimulated, they release epinephrine and norepinephrine. So, and I suppose you could call this adrenaline and noradrenaline if you want. And then these compounds are picked up in the blood, and when they're in the blood, where do they go? Where do they go when they're in the blood? Everywhere, because the blood goes everywhere except for epithelium. So these mediators of sympathetic stimulation go everywhere in the body. So this is, again, an example of mass activation. Your whole body becomes activated with this sympathetic agent. And so we know norepinephrine to be a neurotransmitter, right, because the postganglionic fibers of the sympathetic nervous system secrete norepinephrine. But what would we call these compounds right here that enter the blood? Okay, they're secreted by something that sort of looks like a neuron, right, the modified adrenal medulla cells. But what do we want to call this a neurotransmitter if it gets picked up by the blood? What kind of compound gets picked up by the blood and distributed everywhere in your body? Not a neurotransmitter, but a hormone. So in this particular case, what would you like to call norepinephrine? Is it a hormone or is it a neurotransmitter? So it's kind of confusing. The terminology is not exact. And if you really want to be exact, in this particular case, you probably would like to call epinephrine and norepinephrine a neurohormone, something that's secreted by a neuron, but it is transmitted like a hormone all over the body, and it can bind to adrenergic receptors everywhere in the body. And the adrenal medulla is stimulated during mass activation and carries that signal out. Epinephrine and norepinephrine last for a very long period of time in your circulatory system because there aren't any enzymes that degrade these compounds, right, like in the synapse. So these are longer acting, but it takes a little bit longer time for them to have an effect because the circulatory system has to transport them everywhere in the body. But if it's a neurotransmitter, right, then it acts almost immediately on the postganglionic cell. So that is the trade-off. So here we see what epinephrine and norepinephrine look like. The precursor is tyrosine. That is an amino acid, right? And oops, you can certainly look at that amino acid right here. And what kind of amino acid is tyrosine? Okay. Yes, it is an essential amino acid. Your body can't make it because of this aromatic ring right here. You need to have this in your diet. And then your body can convert it into DOPA, and then dopamine, then norepinephrine, and then epinephrine. And notice that there are small changes in the structure of these compounds, but even these small changes, even if we just methylate one hydrogen on norepinephrine to make epinephrine, that really changes its function in the body. Just small changes can make big changes in physiology. Okay, so just remember, tyrosine is the precursor to both dopamine, norepinephrine, and epinephrine. They're all related because they all start out as a tyrosine. Okay, so that's enough for the sympathetic, but let's just review. How does sympathetic information leave the central nervous system? Does it leave via a cranial nerve or a spinal nerve? A spinal nerve. And any spinal nerve? No. Which kind of spinal nerves? From T1 to L2. So we call that the thoracolumbar division of the autonomic nervous system. Okay, parasympathetic is totally different. Parasympathetic outflow doesn't leave through the thoracic region or the lumbar region. We call it cranial sacral because parasympathetic outflow leaves the central nervous system via cranial nerves and then sacral spinal nerves. Two different areas. All right, but still, it takes two neurons to get to a target tissue, the preganglionic and postganglionic fiber. But again, there's a little bit of difference. In the sympathetic nervous system, the preganglionic fiber is long. Nope, I'm sorry. The preganglionic is short. I'll have to show you a picture. The preganglionic is short and the post is long. The opposite is true for the parasympathetic. And the preganglionic fiber is long, but the postganglionic fibers are almost microscopic. The ganglia sometimes are even inside the target organ, so that the postganglionic fibers hardly have to travel any distance at all. One of the most important nerves is the vagus nerve. And probably from anatomy, you know what the origin of the vagus nerve is. What's the origin, or what is the vagus nerve? What's another name for vagus nerve? Is it a sacral nerve or a cranial nerve? Let's start there. Yeah, it's a cranial nerve. And you know how many cranial nerves are there? There's 12. Which one of those 12 is the vagus? It is number 10. Yeah. And the vagus, what vagus means is like a vagabond. That's where the term came from. So the vagus nerve just travels around all over the body, bringing parasympathetic stimulation to various organs. All right, so it innervates the heart, lungs, esophagus, stomach, pancreas, liver, small intestine, upper half of the large intestine, and it's only a couple from the sacrum that innervate the lower half of the large intestine and urinary and reproductive systems. Okay, so most of the parasympathetic job is carried out by the vagus nerve, at least for the motor divisions. Okay, so here I see some nerves, and here is number 10. And this is autonomic nervous system. Here I see a nerve leaving, cranial nerve number 10, leaving the central nervous system. So what division of the autonomic nervous system is this? Parasympathetic or sympathetic?
Yeah.
It's got to be parasympathetic, right? Because the parasympathetic is what? Cranial sacral outflow, while sympathetic is thoracolumbar. Right, and there's no sympathetic chain. There's nothing like sympathetic chain for the parasympathetic nervous system, but the similarity is that, of course, there is a preganglionic fiber and a postganglionic fiber. Pre's are myelinated, posts are not myelinated, and here are the terminal ganglia. These little circles represent terminal ganglia. They are located, okay, they're located in the target tissue. So these postganglionic fibers for parasympathetic is, they're very short. But the postganglionic fiber for sympathetic outflow is long. Okay? And again, you can see it here. Parasympathetic, for instance, in the uterus, these postganglionic fibers are very short. And the postganglionic fibers in the heart are very short. So the terminal ganglia are embedded in the organ that it innervates. So here we have a ganglia. Preganglionic cell or fiber comes in. And here's the cell body of the postganglionic fiber. And this is a regular chemical synapse. So the preganglionic fiber has to release what? What does it have to release to pass information to the postganglionic fiber? Yeah, neurotransmitter. And it just so happens that the preganglionic fiber for parasympathetics is also cholinergic. And the postganglionic fiber has nicotinic receptors. So what can you tell me about what's the effect of the preganglionic fiber on the postganglionic fiber if the postganglionic has nicotinic receptors? It's always excitatory, right? Because that's the only thing that it can be. Now here's a little bit of difference. We said that the postganglionic fiber for sympathetic, which is right here, is not a cholinergic, it is adrenergic. But for the parasympathetic, the postganglionic fiber is also cholinergic, right? So the pre and the postganglionic fibers for parasympathetic nervous system are cholinergic. But now here is something a little bit different. There are receptors for acetylcholine in these various visceral organs, and they are not nicotinic channels, they are muscarinic. And did you remember anything about muscarinic channels in terms of how they can stimulate or how they can produce a response in a target organ? Nicotinic are always excitatory, but muscarinic could be either, right? They could be excitatory or they could be inhibitory depending on the receptor type. So you might ask yourself a question, how is it that one neurotransmitter can produce various different effects in the body? And your answer would be, the neurotransmitter is the same, but receptor types can change. And so one neurotransmitter can have different effects on different organs depending on what the receptor is in that particular organ. For instance, nicotinic within the ganglion, but muscarinic in the target tissue. And when we looked at those receptor types, sometimes they can be hyperpolarizing or inhibiting or depolarizing and excitatory. All depends on the type of cholinergic receptor it is, or what type of muscarinic receptor it is. Okay. So here's a pretty good overall synopsis of your anatomy book. Here is that one exception of having a postganglionic fiber, and it's a sympathetic preganglionic that goes to the adrenal medulla. Okay. Let's look at some effects on various organs. And notice, or remember, we said that the relationship between sympathetic and parasympathetic is antagonistic, right? So if one is excitatory, the other will be inhibitory. You can't always tell which one is the excitatory one. So let's see if that is sort of true, and maybe I'll point out some other special circumstances. In the eye, we have the iris, right? And that iris can constrict or dilate. And what state is your iris in right now? Is dilated, right? Because it's kind of dark in here, right? So what dilates? Well, it is a sympathetic effect that causes dilation. And of course, when you're in a stressful situation, that certainly makes sense. You want a lot of light entering the retina to perceive what's happening around you. All right, so if sympathetic dilates the pupil, what would you expect parasympathetic to do? Constrict the pupil. There are different muscles, okay, but nonetheless, that is still what the effect is on the iris. There are circular muscles and radial muscles, and in the next chapter, we're actually going to look at that. Okay. In terms of far vision, this is what we call accommodation. Sympathetic causes relaxation for far vision, and parasympathetic contraction for near vision. And again, this is just automatically taken care of for you when you look at objects that are either close or far away. Sweat gland. Right? Sweat glands are stimulated by the sympathetic nervous system, but what about the parasympathetic nervous system? It has no effect on sweat glands. So there is not dual innervation, right, on sweat glands, and we're going to see that that is also the case in some other organs. It is usually dually innervated, or an organ is usually dually innervated for antagonistic reasons, but not for sweat glands. All right, salivary gland, part of your digestive tract. What was one way that we characterized the parasympathetic nervous system? Sympathetic, we said fight or flight. Parasympathetic is rest and digest. Right, so that just means parasympathetic is excitatory on your digestive system. And is that what we see here? Sympathetic causes decreased secretion of saliva. Parasympathetic causes an increased secretion. So in this case, parasympathetic is excitatory and sympathetic is inhibitory. The adrenal medulla, when it releases epinephrine and norepinephrine, right, there's no parasympathetic effect on that organ at all. Right, so it's just singly innervated. The heart is a little bit complicated. So let's look at the heart. When we think of the heart, we can think of it in two main ways. The heart rate, which you can measure pretty easily just by counting your pulse. Something that's a little bit more difficult to measure, and that is the force of contraction. Where is the heart rate controlled? Give me the name of the place. Okay. So it is in an atrium, and particularly it's what? The sinoatrial node, the SA node, controls the heart rate. So we see that the heart rate is under sympathetic control and parasympathetic, and indeed they are antagonistic to each other. So sympathetic tone, increase in sympathetic tone increases heart rate. Parasympathetic causes a decrease in heart rate. So that's a very important parameter that you need to have antagonistic control over. But if we look at force of contraction, sympathetic nerve fibers only go to the atria and the ventricles, but there are no parasympathetic nerves that go to the ventricles, so parasympathetic nervous system really has no effect or can have no effect on the force of contraction of your heart. So the ventricles are under just single innervation from the sympathetic nervous system. Lungs, airways in particular, we see that sympathetic effect is inhibitory, causes dilation, makes it much easier to breathe, and parasympathetic causes constriction. Right, so again, there's nice dual innervation right here. When we look at these other organs of the digestive tract, we see that sympathetic, for instance, is inhibitory, and parasympathetic is excitatory. You can, the only thing you can say is that these effects are going to be different. But sometimes these effects are cooperative. So for instance, if we look at the penis, or just sexual response probably would be a better way of thinking of this, the sympathetic nervous system is responsible for ejaculation, but the parasympathetic is responsible for erection. And so these two systems now really are not antagonistic, but they actually work together, right? Because there's no sense having ejaculation without ejection, or I mean ejaculation without erection. Okay, so you don't have to memorize everything in this chart, but just kind of look at some of these things. Oh, here's another one that I wanted for you to look at, having to do with the liver. Where is liver? Okay, here's liver. We see that the parasympathetic nervous system does not go to the liver. You learn an important function of the liver. Let's talk about what some of the functions of the liver are. Anybody remember a function of the liver? Especially when we were looking at the cell respiration chapter, we have a bunch of diagrams with liver in it. Okay, responsible for breakdown of glucose for glycolysis. Yeah, it's for that. That's one thing. But I'm thinking of more than that. How about glycogenesis? Right? One function of the liver is to store glycogen. And when blood glucose levels decrease, the liver can undergo a process by chopping those glucoses off and put it back into the blood so that blood glucose concentration doesn't decrease. What do we call that when glycogen is broken down? Glycogenolysis. Yeah, glycogenolysis. So let's think of that and look at the liver. All right, so sympathetic stimulation, right, causes glycogen hydrolysis, but probably the real word you want to put in here is what? Glycogenolysis, right? And what's the effect on blood glucose under sympathetic stimulation then? What would happen to blood glucose? Increase or decrease? It would increase. That's right. So anything that produces a sympathetic response is going to increase blood glucose levels. And notice there's not any antagonism, right, to help control or moderate that effect. So when somebody's under a stressful situation, okay, does that promote diabetes or inhibit diabetes? It promotes, right? So there's nothing that really blunts that effect, right, that glycogenolysis. And there are medications that can blunt that effect, but it's not normally operating in people. That's something that you'll probably notice in this class, that there are many mechanisms in your body that increase blood glucose, but very few that decrease blood glucose. So just because of the way our bodies are put together and how they function, we're all kind of susceptible to diabetes mellitus because there are very few things that decrease blood glucose. But you could probably tell me one. It's way back in your memory. It's buried in your memory. It's like the last thing you want to think about for decreasing blood glucose. And that is? Insulin is a hormone. True. Okay. That is one really important thing. But there's something else. And maybe even more important. And that is exercise. That's why I'm telling you it's buried way far away in your mind somewhere. Okay? So exercise will work even without insulin to decrease blood glucose levels. Okay. Muscles will take up glucose. Because when a muscle exercises, some things inside the cell begin to operate as if insulin was present. So insulin is a passport that glucose needs to get into the cell. It needs a special transporter called that GLUT4 transporter. That might even be on the test this time. It's in an endosome. And when a skeletal muscle exercises, that cell puts GLUT4 transporters into the plasma membrane of the muscle cells, which is exactly the same thing as what insulin does, just by exercising a muscle. Okay, so I don't know if anybody knows a diabetic, but what is the first level of treatment for diabetes? Is diet and exercise. Yeah, if they can be treated that way, then that is much better. All right, so let's make sure that we understand these neurotransmitters. We've talked about some cholinergic and adrenergic fibers. All right, here I see a nice central nervous system, which is what? Brain, spinal cord. And I see some outflow patterns coming from the central nervous system. I see some coming from the brain. Is that sympathetic or parasympathetic? It's got to be parasympathetic, right? I see some leaving from the sacral region. Is that parasympathetic, sympathetic, or both? It could be both. What is that? Only parasympathetic, right? Now I see some from the thoracic region and lumbar region. Could that be parasympathetic? Absolutely not. It can only be sympathetic. Okay, so let's look at the scheme that we have right here. Notice that the sympathetic preganglionic fibers are short, the postganglionic are long. All right, the opposite is true for the parasympathetic. The preganglionic fibers are long, but the posts are short. All the pre's are myelinated, the posts are not myelinated. And what is the neurotransmitter between the preganglionic and postganglionic cell within the ganglia? What is the neurotransmitter? Acetylcholine for all of them. Doesn't matter if it's parasympathetic or sympathetic. And the cell bodies of the postganglionic fibers all have nicotinic type receptors. So preganglionic stimulation is always going to be excitatory on these. But now let's look at the neurotransmitter for the postganglionic fibers. We see that for these three examples of sympathetic outflow, it is going to be norepinephrine. So we want to consider these postganglionic fibers not cholinergic but adrenergic fibers. Right? And so there have to be adrenergic receptors on the target tissues that these postganglionic fibers go to. There is sort of one example to the pre- and postganglionic fiber outflow pattern, and that is there's a preganglionic fiber that goes to the adrenal medulla, and when that preganglionic fiber releases acetylcholine, because that happens every single time, then the cells of the adrenal medulla don't send electrical impulses anywhere. What do? They just release, they secrete norepinephrine and epinephrine into the extracellular space, and then it's picked up by a capillary, and then it's transported everywhere in the body. And then that epinephrine and norepinephrine can diffuse out of another capillary in some other location in the body. And then that's just a way of delivering a sympathetic signal all over the body. So in that particular case, norepinephrine really should be considered a neurohormone. Not really a hormone, not really a neurotransmitter, but something that actually is both. And so here is the interface, or one example of an interface between the nervous system and the endocrine system. And we're going to look at the endocrine system pretty soon. In a lot of classes, we don't study the nervous system by itself and the endocrine system by itself. We actually study them together. And if that's the case, what do you think the name of that chapter would be called? Would it be called the nervous system or the endocrine system? It would be the neuroendocrine system. All right, so here is just, for us, here's one example. We'll look at some other examples later on in the class. So what about, let's see if you can answer these questions. Think of the parasympathetic nervous system and the postganglionic fiber. So are the postganglionic fibers of parasympathetic cholinergic or adrenergic? Okay, so postganglionic fiber for parasympathetic. Postganglionic is what? The first one, first cell, or second?
First.
It's the postganglionic is the second one. It's the distal cell, and for parasympathetic, it is cholinergic. Okay. What about for the postganglionic fiber in the sympathetic nervous system? Are those cholinergic or adrenergic? Those are adrenergic, right? Not 100% of the time, but over 90% of the time. Now, what about the preganglionic parasympathetic? Is that cholinergic or adrenergic? Cholinergic. What about the preganglionic fiber for the sympathetic nervous system? Is it cholinergic or adrenergic?
Cholinergic.
Well, but wait a second. You said that the parasympathetic preganglionic was cholinergic. Is it the same for sympathetic? And the answer would be yes, it is. Okay? So I tried to trick you a little bit, just to get those brain cells working. All right, so all of these preganglionics release what? Acetylcholine, 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 acetylcholine. And they are nicotinic-type receptors. Okay. Norepinephrine works through not an ion channel, but a G-protein-coupled receptor, just like muscarinic channels do. So norepinephrine could be excitatory or inhibitory, depending on circumstances. All right, well, we looked at a classical synapse from an axon terminus a little bit earlier. And for the autonomic nervous system, we want to modify that a little bit. We saw that synaptic vesicles release neurotransmitter only at the terminal button of a somatic neuron. But for an autonomic nerve fiber, for instance, like this postganglionic fiber right here, we see that there are swellings all along the axon. And in these swellings, there are synaptic vesicles, and when an action potential comes down this axon, It causes the movement of those vesicles to the cell membrane and exocytosis of neurotransmitter at this location and this one and this one and this one and this one and this one. Not just the axon terminus, but all along the axon of this autonomic neuron. And these things we call varicosities. And so there are synapses all along this whole route that the axon is traveling, so sometimes we call this synapsis en passant. So there are many synapses here. And here I see a cell. This is a muscle cell. Could you identify this muscle cell right here as far as the type is concerned? Would you think that this is a skeletal muscle? Okay. Could you think this is a skeletal muscle? Because what nervous system goes to skeletal muscle? Is it autonomic? No, it is somatic, right? So here we see autonomic because I got parasympathetic and sympathetic. We know that it can't go to skeletal muscle. Right, and this one is not cardiac muscle, this is smooth muscle. So smooth muscle sometimes is dually innervated. So when an action potential comes down through these varicosities, then the sympathetic will release norepinephrine, the parasympathetic will release acetylcholine, and they have their own G-protein coupled receptors. We have adrenergic receptors and cholinergic receptors. And then the smooth muscle cell is under the influence of both the parasympathetic and sympathetic, and the smooth muscle cell then gets to decide what it wants to do based on the level of norepinephrine and acetylcholine, whether it's going to contract or relax or increase rate of contraction. Right? That is completely different compared to a skeletal muscle. Right? Can a skeletal muscle ever make up its mind to contract or not contract? The answer is no, because there's only nicotinic receptors on skeletal muscle. So as soon as acetylcholine binds, that skeletal muscle is going to contract. It can never make up its own mind to do anything else. That's why we say it's under voluntary control. But smooth muscle can make up its own mind depending on the balance of norepinephrine and acetylcholine, right? Or how these adrenergic receptors are functioning compared to the cholinergic receptors. So that signal is mixed within the smooth muscle cell. Okay, let's look at, in particular, let's break that system down a little bit. And first, let's look at adrenergic stimulation. And it works through G-protein coupled receptors, which means that it could either be excitatory or inhibitory, depending on how that G-protein is coupled to ion channels in the membrane. And so we have to then divide adrenergic receptors into some groups and subgroups. Right, so there are two major subtypes of adrenergic receptors. These are called alpha and beta. Oh, take a guess, which one were discovered first? Well, alpha probably, right? Okay, and then another group was discovered and they were just called beta adrenergic. And as a matter of fact, each one of these subtypes have subtypes of their own. Like there's alpha 1, alpha 2, beta 1, beta 2. And since these receptors control everything in your body except for skeletal muscle, do you think these are important to know something about? If they control everything in your body except skeletal muscle? And the answer would be yes, because they control most things in your body. Okay. All of these, alpha 1, alpha 2, beta 1, beta 2, are G protein coupled, working through a second messenger. So in this particular case, what would be the first messenger? Yeah, the, and what kind of neurotransmitter? You know exactly which one it is. It is norepinephrine, right, from the postganglionic fiber. And the beta-type receptors use cyclic AMP as a second messenger, while the alpha-type receptors use calcium as a second messenger. And where does this calcium come from? Yeah, right, so when that G protein is activated, right, it dissociates from the receptor and a subunit of that G protein can open up a calcium channel, and then remember calcium is high outside the cell, it floods to the inside of the cell and it's going to change the physiology of that cell. On the other hand, a subunit of that G protein can bump into something that will take AMP and convert it into cyclic AMP if it's a beta receptor. What is that something in the membrane that can take ATP and make cyclic AMP out of it? That's a chemical reaction. What do you know that can catalyze chemical reactions in your body? We'll speed them up. That's an enzyme. Yeah, so that G protein bumps into an enzyme, and you should probably know the name of that enzyme by now. That is called adenylate cyclase, right? And when adenylate cyclase is activated for beta, when these beta receptors get stimulated, then cyclic AMP builds up inside the cell, and that's the second messenger. Let's look at some of these receptor types in various organs. And I might have to turn the light on. So we see the eye, and we see blood vessels, okay, and we see stomach and intestine, and even liver, right? I mentioned all of the organs that have alpha-1 type receptors, right? And alpha-1, one way to characterize alpha-1, we said, well, let's just look. Eye, contraction of radial fiber. So if sympathetic stimulation causes contraction due to these alpha-1 receptors, is that excitatory or inhibitory? Excitatory. If it causes contraction of a muscle, that is excitatory. Let's look at another alpha-1. Blood vessels in the skin. Arterioles constrict, that smooth muscle constrict. Is that excitatory or inhibitory? Excitatory. Let's look at blood vessels in muscles. Arterioles constrict. Is that excitatory or inhibitory? What have we said so far? 100% excitatory. Do we have any other alpha-1s? Yeah, stomach and intestine. All right. There are alpha-1 receptors there. Norepinephrine causes contraction of sphincters. That slows the passage of material between different divisions of your digestive tract, but nonetheless, right, it causes contraction. So is that excitatory or inhibitory? Excitatory. All right, so what you should remember for alpha-1 is that they are excitatory. They don't cause inhibition. Okay? So alpha-1s, no matter where they are, think of them as being excitatory. And what's the second messenger that's being used for alpha-1s? It is calcium, not cyclic AMP. Okay. And the same thing for glycogenolysis, right? There's an alpha-1 receptor for secretion of glucose from the liver. So again, consider that as being excitatory, not inhibitory. All right, so that's the alpha-1. Alpha-2s, I'm not going to cover in this class because depending on where they are, it has different effects. And maybe I'll just give you one example of an alpha-2 receptor. They're located in the brain, and when they're stimulated with norepinephrine, they can cause a drastic decrease in blood pressure, a huge, huge decrease in blood pressure. And in us, that wouldn't be good. But if you have a patient and they come see you and their blood pressure is 230 over 170, okay, what could happen to them? We haven't talked about blood just yet. Okay, so there's two numbers. But what is a normal blood pressure? Not 270. It is? Yeah, 120 over 80. So when somebody has that high of blood pressure, that means that a blood vessel in their body could blow up at any time. Right? And it could be immediately fatal. So people show up like that, and they have to be treated immediately. There are alpha-2 agonists. There's a drug that will operate on alpha-2 receptors, and it will almost immediately drop their blood pressure. That will save their life, but they won't feel very good when that happens. Okay? That medication is called clonidine. Maybe you've heard of that. Some people can tolerate it day in and day out, but usually it's only for those emergent kind of situations. Those work by alpha-2. All right, so what else do we have to consider besides alpha-1? So we mostly just looked at alpha-1. What else do we have to consider? The beta receptors, right? And how many kinds of beta receptors do you have? You only got two, beta-1 and beta-2. And they don't work through calcium. They work through cyclic AMP as a second messenger. So let's take a look at this. The heart has beta-1, increased heart rate and contraction strength. So both the rate of contraction and the force of contraction increases. So is beta-1 excitatory or inhibitory? Yeah, it's definitely excitatory, right? Causes an increase in contraction. Let's look at the lungs, bronchioles, airways, right? Dilate due to smooth muscle relaxation. Is that a beta-1? That's a beta-2. So in this case, beta-2 is inhibitory. And even arterioles, beta-2 are inhibitory. They cause relaxation, which then leads to dilation. All right, so there's a really easy way to remember the difference between beta 1 and beta 2. So if your eyes are kind of glassing over at the moment, really think about this, because this will maybe save your life on the test. And even after the test, you should never forget any of this stuff. So, what does the heart have in terms of adrenergic receptors? Alpha, beta. It's got beta. And what kind of beta? Beta 1. Okay, so just point to your heart, beta 1. Now, what about your lungs? What kind of receptors are those? Beta 2. You got two lungs, so you got beta 2 receptors. That's not because they're not named that way. It just so happens, right? So the heart is beta 1, which is what? Excitatory. Beta 2, you got two lungs, they are inhibitory. So do you see my index fingers? How many index fingers am I pointing to my lungs? Two, right? Beta 2, and the heart is beta 1. All right, so that's a nice, easy trick. And so this is super important to know about these different receptor types. Okay. Is this the last slide? Oh, not the last slide. Close to the last slide. All right, so here is an important exam figure. And I see two neurons back to back. Would this be an example of a somatic outflow pathway or an autonomic outflow pathway? Autonomic, right? Because here's a ganglion, here's a ganglia, here's a ganglia, here's a ganglia. Here's the preganglionic fiber on the top row. Here's the postganglionic fiber on the bottom row. And what did we say? It was a neurotransmitter that's released by all preganglionic neurons. Doesn't matter if it's sympathetic or parasympathetic, it's the same. And it is acetylcholine, right? So maybe you should draw an acetylcholine here, 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 here. Would you want to draw acetylcholine in here? Absolutely. What about here? Yeah, what about here? Yes, absolutely. In every particular case, every single instance, it is going to be acetylcholine, and the receptors are always going to be nicotinic, so the postganglionic fibers are always excited when it receives stimulation from the preganglionic fiber. Right? Okay, so do you see in your mind that a nicotinic channel is always excitatory? Because a nicotinic channel just opens, right, when it's stimulated, when acetylcholine binds to a nicotinic channel, it just opens a sodium channel. Sodium rushes inside the cell. You know that to be, what electrical event does that cause when sodium rushes in? Depolarization. And is that excitatory or inhibitory? That's excitatory because that makes the membrane potential go up to threshold, which will stimulate an action potential. Okay. Here I see a postganglionic fiber, and it is releasing acetylcholine. All right, so here is another cholinergic fiber, but it's a postganglionic. And what kind of postganglionic fibers that you know about that release acetylcholine? Parasympathetic, right? And now the receptors for the acetylcholine from the postganglionic fiber are muscarinic receptors, muscarinic acetylcholine, which means that it will have various effects depending on what kind of muscarinic receptor it is. It could be excitatory or inhibitory. And we're going to learn some examples throughout the whole class, not today, but through the rest of the class, we'll look at some of these different kinds of channels. All right, but for sympathetic stimulation, okay, it's not acetylcholine. All of these, right, are basically adrenergic fibers. And here is the postganglionic fiber releasing norepinephrine. It's going to stimulate alpha-1 adrenergic receptors, right? And what do you know about alpha-1? Are they inhibitory or excitatory? Mm-hmm. They're excitatory, causing constriction, vasoconstriction, right, for instance. Here is beta-1. Where does beta-1 go to? Or what organ has beta-1?
Heart.
Your heart. And what's the effect, excitatory or inhibitory? Yeah, beta-1 are excitatory on the heart. Maybe you've heard of beta blockers, somebody who has high blood pressure, right? So if you block a beta-1 receptor that reduces heart rate, force of contraction, hopefully that affects their blood pressure, right? Reduces their blood pressure. Here we see just another example, a beta-2 adrenergic receptor. Where do we find beta-2s? Just one example is good. In your lungs. Right, and is it excitatory or inhibitory? Okay, so think of fight or flight. When you're faced with a stressful situation, and would it be better for you to breathe more easily, get more oxygen in your body, or is that not important? Is ventilation, is breathing in important when you're in a stressful situation? Like you're going to fly away someplace or run away someplace. Is oxygen important? Absolutely. So the way that you can increase ventilation is by dilating the airways in your lungs so that air can move in and out of your lungs much more quickly. And in order to dilate those passageways, what has to happen? Constriction or relaxation of smooth muscle. Relaxation, right? So the beta 2 are inhibitory. Beta 1 are excitatory, beta 2 are inhibitory. But always think in terms of that fight or flight or rest and digest mechanism to understand what might be happening. So really important figure. So make sure you can draw in all these different neurotransmitters. Know if it's excitatory, inhibitory, and the various receptor types. Okay, what is nice on this slide is that we didn't look at any subtypes of muscarinic receptors. And there are subtypes, I just want to tell you that, but I don't focus on the different kinds of subtypes of muscarinic, but certainly the different subtypes of alpha and beta you should be aware of. Okay, so acetylcholine is used at all neuromuscular junctions, right? That's a somatic outflow on skeletal muscle. All preganglionic autonomic neurons use acetylcholine, and one other place would be parasympathetic postganglionic fibers. And so everywhere in the somatic nervous system, everywhere for preganglionic and the autonomic, but primarily it's the parasympathetic and the postganglionic fiber. Remember, cholinergic has two receptor types, nicotinic and muscarinic. Nicotinic type are blocked by curare. Muscarinic has to work through a G protein coupled receptor. Right? Can be stimulated by a compound called muscarin, and it's blocked by atropine. So if there is an agent that overly stimulates the muscarinic receptors, then one way to think of helping with something that's almost like an antidote would be atropine, because it can block those muscarinic receptors, and that will protect somebody from overstimulating those receptors. And another compound that does that would be like nerve gas. Various kinds of nerve gases will bind to muscarinic receptors, right, and overstimulate the parasympathetic nervous system. Atropine can block that, can act almost like an antidote to many kinds of neurotoxins and nerve gases. So on this, I think this is our last slide. Ooh, almost last slide. Okay. We have the two subclasses of cholinergic receptors. Here I just see a nice simple ion channel. When two acetylcholines bind, we see primarily sodium entering the cell that causes depolarization or excitation. A really good example of this would be the neuromuscular junction, right? Neuromuscular junctions only have these nicotinic receptors. Okay, you find them sometimes in the central nervous system. Muscarinic receptors always work through a G protein, not directly with the ion channel, right? So when acetylcholine binds to the receptor, that activates the G protein, which can bump into a potassium channel, opening it up so that potassium leaves. And then what happens to the membrane potential when potassium leaves? Okay. I think you could figure that out, probably, right? And even without memorizing it, because you know potassium is a cation. When a cation leaves, that means the inside of the cell has to become more negative, right? And that forces the membrane potential farther away from threshold, and we call that hyperpolarizing, or what? That inhibition. So, for instance, that could cause a decrease in heart rate. So what kind of receptor is this right here? Oh, no, this is a muscarinic. Okay, so it's just a muscarinic. I'm not going to ask you the subtypes. Okay, so this is one case causing inhibition. Here's that a different kind of G protein coupled receptor, and in this particular case, it can close a potassium channel. So instead of causing hyperpolarization, it could cause depolarization because it's keeping potassium inside the cell, right? And that is excitation. Or maybe the G protein here will bump into a sodium or calcium channel, causing it to open. That will also cause depolarization or excitation. causing smooth muscles to contract. A good example of that would be in the digestive tract. So here would be an example of why acetylcholine is excitatory on the digestive tract, because it can close potassium channels or open up sodium or calcium channels. So that's a muscarinic. Muscarinic can either be inhibitory or excitatory. All depends on how the G protein is coupled to ion channels, different kinds of ion channels in the cell membrane. Okay, this slide right here, I don't want to make a big deal of this slide, but what can you see about nicotinic? Skeletal muscle and autonomic ganglia, they always cause depolarization, which is what? Excitation. Okay? So muscarinic can either be depolarizing or hyperpolarizing, depolarizing in smooth muscle and glands, increasing their activity. But in the heart, muscarinic receptors, there's a special type that cause hyperpolarization. And what does that do to the heart? That inhibits the heart. And that is what? Parasympathetic. What will stimulate the heart? Sympathetic. Yeah, so sympathetic. So parasympathetic inhibits the heart. Sympathetic will stimulate, excite the heart. But they all work through G protein coupled receptors and various kinds of ion channels. All right, so that's it for the autonomic nervous system. That's the last bit for the test coming up. And I'm glad today's not Tuesday, because then you would have the test on Thursday. Hopefully you got some time over the weekend to review some of this stuff. It's really not as bad as it sounds. It's very wordy with all this preganglionic, postganglionic, sympathetic, parasympathetic, but I think it's pretty easy to organize in your mind. And I even appreciate the difference between alpha, beta receptors for the sympathetic, for adrenergic receptors is not too bad. Okay, I want to give you just a little bit of an orientation to sensory physiology. Right? And in order for you to sense a stimulus, what do you need? Think of a response loop. Response loop always starts with a stimulus which has an effect on a receptor of some kind, right? And we're going to classify receptors by the kind of energy that they are responsible for and how many there are and where they're located, okay? Some of these receptors can be simple nerve endings or specialized nerve endings. Here we have just simple nerve endings for pain and temperature. Right, but here's a Pacinian corpuscle that is much more complicated. It has much more structure. It's not just a simple nerve ending. Merkel's discs are more complicated. Meissner's corpuscles. So these things are for pressure and vibration. Free nerve endings are just for temperature and pain sensation. And where do you have sensation of pain on your body? Or if I took a pin and poked a pin into the back of your hand, would you feel that? Okay. Yeah, soft tissues. Yeah, bone doesn't have much in the way of pain receptors. But in terms of location, if I had a pin and I stuck that pin in the back of your hand, would you feel it? What about your earlobe? Would you feel it? Yes. What about the back of your knee? Yes. Front of your knee? Yeah, no matter where I poke you with a pin, you would say, ouch. Right? Then maybe smack me, because you have pain receptors all over your body. What about if I took an ice cube? And where did we put that pin? Put an ice cube on the back of your hand. Could you feel that change in temperature? Okay, what about your earlobe? Yes, you could feel it. What about the back of your kneecap? Would you feel an ice cube if I put it there? Yeah, what about your belly button? Would you feel it? Yeah, so you have temperature receptors all over your body. If you have receptors all over your body for a particular stimulus modality, we call that a general sensation. So general sensation, you have receptors all over your body. Doesn't really matter. Don't have to go to a special place. Okay. Now, let's take a flashlight and shine the flashlight only on the back of your knee. Okay. Would you see that light? No. Because why? You don't have a receptor there for light. What about your kneecap? Would you see it? No. Your earlobe? No. All right. Where can you perceive light?
Your
only your eyes. So if you can perceive some kind of energy modality in only one, maybe two locations, that's not a general sense, that is a special sense, right? And you have a couple kinds of special senses. Let's think of a couple others. What about if I took a sugar cube and placed it in your ear? Would you hear it or taste it? No. What about your kneecap? No. Where would that sugar cube have to go? Yeah, only on your tongue. So again, taste is a special sense. We call that the gustatory sensation. So you have special receptors on your tongue for various kinds of chemicals, like sugars, things that are bitter, sour. Okay, that's a special sense. What could be another sense? How about if I hooked up like a little earbud that you use to listen to music and put it in your nose? Can you hear with your nose?
No.
No. And if I put that earbud on your kneecap, could you hear?
No.
Where does that earbud have to go?
No.
Only your ear. So what about hearing? Hearing is a special sense. Right. What else?
No.
Yeah, smell is a special sense. What do we want to smell as an example?
Coffee.
Okay, coffee. Put some coffee on your kneecap. Can you smell it? Put on your belly button, can you smell it? No. Where does it have to go? In your nose. So that sense of smell is a special sense as well. We call that olfaction. So the special senses, we got five special senses. We have vision, hearing, gustation, which is taste, olfaction, which is smell, and then also equilibrium, a sense of equilibrium. We have two senses of equilibrium. Those are in our ear as well. They give us a sense for spinning and for acceleration. And we're going to look at those. Those are special senses. Okay. Here is another sense that I want you to consider. There are receptors in muscle, skeletal muscle, that can measure tension within a muscle. There are receptors in joints that can measure angulation in a joint. So if we ask you to close your eyes and I take your hand and I put it over your head without watching what happened, could you tell me that your hand is over your head?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is yes. Because you have all of these different kinds of receptors, we call that proprioception. So you have proprioceptors in muscles and joints, and they protect your joints and muscles. Are those special senses or general senses?
Mm-hmm.
Proprioception, is that general or special? The sense of body position. Okay, and it is general because proprioceptors are located all over your body, in all skeletal muscles and joints. So even though it seems like a special sense, it's not because you have those receptors all over the body. Okay, so that's the big difference between general sensation and special sensation. So what do these receptors do? Remember, energy can change from one form to another, but it can't either be created or destroyed. So receptors change one form of energy into another, maybe a chemical compound into action potentials, or maybe a sound energy into action potentials, right? So that's the job of a receptor. They transduce one form of energy into another. And each type responds particularly well to one modality, one form of energy, like sound and light and pressure. So what are your eyes best at responding to? Sound, pressure, light, right. So they respond best to light, that is their prime modality, but if somebody presses on your eyeball, maybe gets hit with a volleyball or something, okay, what happens? You can see light, right? And you have the perception of light. So if there is some energy that goes way beyond the normal form, then these receptors can respond and send action potentials into the central nervous system, but they're most easily stimulated by their proper modality. Okay, and you can tell different modalities of energy because action potentials are different. Is that true? How can we tell the difference between sound and light, for instance? Are the action potentials different? Okay, what can you tell me about an action potential? Do they add together? They don't summate. And how do they propagate? Do they die away as they move through the nervous system? They do not. What about the amplitude? Is exactly the same. The duration, exactly the same. So, when an action potential is produced by light in your eye, an action potential produced by sound pressure in your ear, the action potentials are exactly the same. They don't change. So how is it that you can tell the difference between vision and hearing? Because those action potentials go to a different part of your brain. So when your eyes generate action potentials, what part of the brain does it go to? It goes to the, this is some anatomy, it goes to the occipital lobe. Action potentials go directly to the occipital lobe. When the occipital lobe is stimulated, then you'll have the perception of light. But for hearing, where do those action potentials go? The ear produces action potentials when sound pressure is there, but they don't go to the occipital lobe, because if they went to the occipital lobe, what would be your perception? It would be vision. You would see something, even though it's getting signals from the ear. So those action potentials don't go to the occipital lobe, they go to the temporal lobe, which is where the primary auditory cortex is. Okay. But if your eyes sent action potentials to the temporal lobe, what would be your experience? If it didn't send it to the occipital lobe but to the temporal lobe, when light is shined on your eyes, what would be your sensation? You would hear something, right? So it depends on the part of the brain that is being activated, and it's activated by action potentials, which are exactly the same no matter where they're going. Okay, and it's just the job of different receptors to transduce different forms of energy into action potentials, and then that signal is delivered to the proper part of the brain. So sensory receptors can be classified. Some respond to chemical stimuli. We call those chemoreceptors. Some respond to light. We call those photoreceptors. Some respond to changes in temperature. Those are thermoreceptors. Others respond to changes in the shape of a cell due to pressure changes or vibration, pressure or vibration. We call these mechanoreceptors, or maybe if a cell starts to stretch, right, mechanoreceptors will become activated. Some respond to damaging kinds of stimuli, could be temperature, could be chemicals. We call these nociceptors. Right, and nociceptors are sending signals to the brain that's saying that you are experiencing some kind of damaging stimulus to your body, right? Some kind of painful stimulus. And proprioception, what did we say proprioceptors are for? Body position. Yeah, they give you positional information. Okay. All right, we talked about general versus special. General are from receptors all over the body. Special is from receptors in just a couple locations. Right. And then different receptors respond a little bit differently to stimulus. And I think we're going to start next time after the test right here. Right. We're going to look at the difference between tonic and phasic receptors. Did you talk about this stuff in lab yet? Did you get to sensation in lab? Oh, today. Oh, okay. I'm jipping you guys out of an orientation, but that's okay. Okay, so Tuesday, photo ID, pencil, eraser, please, and your Scantron. Sign-in sheet is going around someplace.